Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cersini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofowokin.
This week, Amazon launches the Fire set-top box, OkCupid takes a political stance and blocks Firefox, news from Microsoft's Build conference, DVD CD ripping is finally legal in the UK, April Fools on the web, and much, much more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and you can find our subscription links in our show notes. And please leave us a review on iTunes if you do. Add us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I just wanted to give a brief shout out to Disney Movies Everywhere, which is a new service that has just rolled out from Disney. It's basically Disney's cloud-based movie service.
That service is awesome.
Yeah, and I have to preface this with a disclaimer that I'm an employee of Disney, although I don't make any profit by by mentioning them. I just actually love the service. And I'll tell you why. Like, yes, it's a great service. They have this vast library of great of classic, and it's deep too. They have really sort of long tail.
That whole vault thing went away with the digital stuff that you can get from these guys. Yeah. That's great.
Like all of their really obscure titles that hardly anyone remembers anymore is available on that Disney Movies Everywhere.
The Rescuers, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I got this as well. Like I don't know if I sent you an email about it, but a couple weeks ago, I was able to get The Incredibles for free.
Yeah, they're having an offer right now where if you join right now, you get The Incredibles for free as part of your library.
Right, and that's like my favorite thing. And if I think about it and I look at that and I say, you know, if I spent $20 a month, at the end of a couple of years, I'd have like a huge stock of these movies. Because they're basically like, you know, between like $15.95 and $25.95 a month. Not a month, but period. When you buy them, you just buy them. You own them. And the way I look at it, part of me is like, well, you know, once I start popping out little ones and all that stuff, I definitely love them to see the kind of things that I saw when I was a kid. You know, and I like really weird ones like Sleeping Beauty that the critics hated back when it came out. But yeah, I mean, it's really cool to be able to get and hold on to the movie, and you can watch it wherever you want. But it also goes into your iTunes library, which is double the fun.
Yeah, exactly. Now this is, I mean, what brings this up for me is that I had like a little unexpected surprise this week. I've got about 200 plus Blu-ray discs currently, and at the beginning of the year, I went through and redeemed all of the digital copy codes for the Ultraviolet service. And I also did a small handful of the iTunes digital copy codes. And at the time, I hadn't done it in a while. Like I'd had these Blu-ray discs and I never did the iTunes a digital copy redemption because it was such a hassle because a lot of the ones that I had wanted you to take a physical disc from the Blu-ray pack, put it in the drive, and then the disc had to be inserted in order to utilize the code, unlike the Ultraviolet service where you just type in the code. So I went through at the time and I typed in a few of these codes and they had expired. Like there was a limited time for how long you could actually, the codes were valid, which I think is kind of bullshit too. Like you've bought the disc, the code should be valid for as long as you own the disc. It's your copy. So I was a little upset, and I didn't bother doing any more of the iTunes digital copies. So when I joined Disney Movies Everywhere, I went through the Blu-rays that I had that were Disney movies, and they also have like their own sort of code called Movie Magic Rewards.
Yeah, Disney Movie Rewards. It was a big deal back in the early part of the 2010, 2011.
Yeah. So what I discovered was those Disney movie rewards, which were just essentially like redemption rewards back then, since the Disney Movies Anywhere service has been turned on, those rewards are now actually digital copy vouchers. So
sweet.
So I found myself with about 10 digital copies of Disney movies that I didn't previously have. So I've got an extra update to my collection. Now, on a whim, because they asked you to, because in order to redeem the Disney Movie Anywhere thing, you also have to put the disc in and redeem it through iTunes. On a whim, I went back through my old collection and I found all of those old Blu-rays that I had iTunes codes for that I didn't bother redeeming. And I went through there, even the expired ones, and I went through there and I typed the codes in, and I discovered Apple made some sort of change in their policy, and now all of those expired codes are actually active. Not only active, but they now act as iTunes Cloud
downloadables.
So
that's fantastic.
So instead of being local, I can do it. I have copies of all those movies in the cloud, and I added literally like 30 plus movies to my iTunes video account.
You got a lot of like Disney movies, dude.
Well, no, this was not just Disney movies. This was just the other
digital movies. Yeah, I mean, that's great. That's kind of how it just should be, right? Like you get a code.
Yeah.
That code is tied to the disc. Boom. I mean, like frankly, it's got real big implications for Blu-rays that you purchase, but I think this is exactly how it should be for things like the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One.
Yep.
You put in your original disc from your original game that you bought and you own, and when you do, these new consoles, they actually register your disc to your ID.
Yeah.
So like that disc is yours until you like give up ownership. And then it should, you know, if it's an older game, it should say, "Here you go. You got it.
Yep.
It's yours
yep.
now." Like it's digital, it's on your hard drive, or you're going to play it on demand or whatever, but it's yours now.
Buy
Instead
once.
Of this idea that you have to pay $10 to get the same game back
or
whatever. That's just how it should be. And if the console that does that is the console that will win.
But it should be buy once, use everywhere, right?
Right. I mean, that's the model we look at with digital music content via Amazon and Apple, the two biggest guys that are dropping it out there. And that's the model that we look at with software in the new era. I mean, we're going to talk about Microsoft a little later, but Microsoft is doing that with Office, and Apple's been doing that with iTunes forever. And Android does it as well. Buy once, automatically downloads everywhere. Let's get it on, you know?
On a related note, Google Chromecast just added Vudu as one of their services, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about Chromecast in a little while when we get to the Amazon thing and we compare, but Chromecast is awesome, and I love it, but this Amazon announcement showed up, and I completely forgot that Chromecast existed.
Dwayne, why don't you tell us about what you've been playing with this week?
Oh, so not too much. On the tech side, I've been doing some research into World War One, because it's the war that we all know happened, but nobody really knows about, like just the circumstances to get into it.
We had a brief discussion last week regarding the tech of World War One that has the legacy tech that has lasted through today, and we talked about barbed wire.
Exactly, not the scantily clad heroine, but the actual technology that keeps people out of places that they're not supposed to be in. You look at World War One, and there's all this stuff in our modern life that came out of that effort. It was a massive effort, and it was a war of technology. It started because of technology, and it ended because of technology, more than almost any other war before. Frankly, the pessimist look at it was that you had a whole bunch of kings and queens who were like, "I've got all this tech, these guns, and I've got a whole bunch of people who are my subjects. I can kill anybody I want. I'm not worried about it." And that's a big part of why it started. But the thing I want to talk about today is air traffic control. The idea that you can planes can talk to the ground and the ground can talk to planes and like coordinate it, that all came from World War One. In fact, on Mental Floss, where I've been doing some of the research, they have a pretty good little snippet about it. And basically they're like, you know, two-way radios in planes during like 1915 showed up because they had so many planes in the sky. By the time 1917 hit, human voices were transmitted instead of just telegraph messages from the plane to the operators on the ground or from planes to other planes. So here's like a fundamental thing that like flying, commercial flying, is a fundamental aspect of the of our lifestyle today. And the fact that none of that, the whole like communication system for it came about when people were in like planes that used car fuel, that had propellers, that didn't go very far but were there to shoot the enemy down, and they needed that kind of control. That's kind of, I don't know, to me that's kind of amazing. So anyway, World War One, I'm all about it this year. It's 100 years since it started. It was terrible. And yeah.
But so many things, so many advancements came out of it. I think every war has that sort of legacy where, out of necessity, technological advancements come out of the war, either as weapons or as other strategic devices.
Absolutely, there is. But the thing about World War One that to me is so fascinating is that, one, it is considered the first – it's the first incidence of what we call globalization today. It was a global conflict because of alliances that stretched across, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles. And, you know, and then at the same time, it was considered the first episode of, like, modern warfare. What we call, you know, like the mobilization of troops, trenches, tanks, the kinds of things that we see as warfare today. And – it's crazy to think that the warfare in the modern era is 100 years old. That's nuts.
Yeah. I'm going to point you toward a series that you I think you would be fascinated with. It's a series from that originally aired on the BBC in 1978. You may have never heard of it, but it's called Connections. And the host of it was a guy by the name of James Burke. And the premise of this series is that he takes a certain event in the past and he traces what came out of that event into our modern day. So he traces a one small bit of revolutionary tech from early history and how that has affected everything that we do today.
It's like the wheel.
Like the wheel. That's a good example. But I think it's available on certain on YouTube. You can find it on YouTube here and there. But it's a really fascinating series, and it's sort of it's right in tune with the stuff that you've been researching.
There you go.
All right, let's talk about some of these headlines. So first off is an article that you pointed me towards, Duane. The San Francisco Giants have adopted Apple's iBeacon technology for this season.
Yeah, it's kind of great. I mean, I've worked at companies that manage kind of real-time events for your mobile phone. And iBeacon is really kind of a watershed moment for these kinds of things. So right now, if you think about our geek world, right? Yeah. If you're the kind of geek that likes sports and everything, you're going to spend $125 on like, you know, MLB everywhere, MLB TV. And you get to sit at home and watch it all the time. But the stadiums, as much as they like the money coming in from that, they really want you – the teams really want you in the stadiums. So how do they do that? The same way the wearable tech has kind of gotten people – some people off their ass or people who are already active to be more active, what they're trying to do with this iBeacon stuff is bring you back into the stadium because they're experiences that you can only have there. And to me, this is pretty exciting because it means that, you know, I don't know about you guys, but we talked about PCL a couple of weeks ago. Whenever you're in a stadium, it's completely useless to use your phone. These stadiums aren't only just getting the iBeacon stuff. They're throwing Wi-Fi in everywhere. So that's like a big piece of what's going on here. But the modernization of these stadiums is kind of like, imagine if you could have a swarm of people hit the hot dog stand, right? Like, you and 15 other people checking in the hot dog stand, you guys all get a free hot dog or something like that. That's kind of like where they're beginning to mess with this. But what's really cool about it is that unlike some of the other team situations like the NFL or the NBA, MLB kind of has this rule set where the governing body, MLB, they choose the technology for the league, and all the stadiums and so on adopt it, right? So when MLB wants a mobile solution, there's an MLB app, and all the teams are on that app. Whereas with, like, football, the NHL, well, the football's pretty good, but the NHL or, like, you know, on basketball, it's kind of like it's left up to ESPN to have an all-encompassing solution. Otherwise, each team has its own thing. So this is kind of exciting to me because the idea is you get to the ballpark and you can suddenly use your phone in a really meaningful manner. You know, beacons are going to allow us to do things like order from our seats and have people bring the food to us. They're going to allow us to do things like, you know, again, swarm, possibly even check in at a place after the game. And if I brought 10 friends, we're all going to get a free drink. Hmm. So it seems like, oh, what the hell, beacons, whatever. But I think it's going to really make it so that you're going to have more fun going out to these kind of like massive things that used to be really unorganized. The biggest thing about beacons that I'm excited about is that if they put them in the parking lots, you can drive into a parking lot at one of these places and your phone can light up telling you that you're next to a free space because you know, they can basically look with and use IR beams to tell what spaces are free, what spaces are not. So the whole parking nightmare, less of a nightmare. All that stuff. So there's just like, I don't know, for me, it's like tech meets real space, sports. I get excited.
Am I cynical to that I'm thinking that the only thing that's going to come from this is more advertising thrown in my face?
I think you are a little cynical. What they want to do is make sure that you're aware of, I think the first things you will see are like definitely some advertising. Hey, there's a deal here, there's a deal there, you know, go to this stand to get whatever. But the biggest things are, you know, beacons can be set up so that you have super finite control about location services. And because of that, you can set it up so that you can swarm. You can it'll tell you something like, Andy, bring three of your friends to this hot dog stand and you'll get all the you'll each get a hot dog free, in addition to, or you'll each buy a hot dog and you'll each get a drink free, but only if you have this many people, things like that. But also you will be able to do things like order from your seat because the beacons will allow the guys who have phones who are bringing around the stuff to know exactly where you're seated. Also, the Wi-Fi-ization of it will too. You don't need beacons for that. But there's also this idea that, you know, things like the parking lot, you will be able to find a spot more easily. And I'm not saying that's going to happen overnight, but over time, as the beacons get, people think more and more uses for these beacons, you're going to see that whole in-stadium experience more and more robust. That's going to be exciting. The idea that, like, hey, everybody in this section, all your phones light up and say, hey, if you do the wave now, you'll all, like, get a free drink or something like that. Right, because they know where you are in the stadium,
yeah.
So they can take complete advantage of what you're doing or not doing. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of cool. Like the idea is like, hey, you know, some kind of contest. Take a selfie of the big, or take a picture of the biggest fan and like put it in. And we know exactly where you're sitting, and you can actually check into your seat. And if your picture wins, everyone will vote on it, then you'll get a free ticket for next game. Things like that. The beacons allow for this really finite understanding of where the user is. And when you know where the user is, you can target that section, you can target that user, you can do all these things to make it so that they can have more fun there, you know?
Yeah, you know what? I think one of the bigger parts of this is that the adoption here. One of the things that we've heard is that a lot of the various other the big, you know, the big Google Android proponent, which, although different from Beacon, sort of collides in that same sort of space, has not really drawn as much usage. And when you now have the backing of a major sports authority in the U.S., and you're not actually physically putting it in, you know, infrastructure that's going to be used fairly, that can be used regularly throughout a sporting season. I think that that's going to be a big seller of getting Beacon in other places. So I think you may see a rise in adoption, and it may ultimately become the standardization, but we'll see.
Yeah, you're right. MLB is a leader in this again because they have a situation where they're like, hey, every team is going to do this. We have crazy amount of teams. We play a crazy amount of games. We have the scale to really pull this off. But another piece of this is the guys who are building these apps, this infrastructure to make use of the beacons, they're going to have to come up with a hack for Android, or they're going to have Android devices use these. It may very well in the beginning say, hey, if you have an iPhone, you're in luck because we have this functionality out the gate, which could screw Android a little bit and drive some more iPhone sales. But I think what's really going to happen is that not so much a competing technology, but a companion technology will show up, whether it's by hack via the developer or coming from Google, that allow the same kind of Bluetooth 4.0 hardware to be used. Regardless, Apple has a lot of clout because everyone running an Apple device pretty much has, when you run an Apple device, the developer doesn't have a lot to think about. I built it for Apple. It's going to work across, iPhones 4S through 5S and let's call it iPhone 6. So I know that I'm going to hit these devices. And frankly, the MLB knows from their own stats who's paying for MLB.tv, and they know who's accessing it. It's happening on Apple TVs, it's happening on iPads, and it's happening on iPhones. And the reason why it's happening that way is basically because there's a lot of data to show that that iPhone users spend more money on these services than Android users. So yeah, but I mean, the whole thing is you're going to be at a ballpark, you're going to be able to use your phone in a meaningful manner, and I think there's almost no more meaningful manner than the next story you have lined up for us, Andy, which is this Twitter thing.
Yeah, so last week Twitter added two new features, photo tagging, which lets you tag the people in your photos, and the best part about that is the tagging doesn't affect the character count in the tweet, so you can tag like 10 people in a photo and still have 140 characters left.
Say it isn't so.
It's so. I wish they would do this with there are other things.
Normal
that I
tweets?
Yeah, well, with other sort of URLs, like you can add more than one URL and it doesn't affect the tagging. But on top of that, they also added the ability to upload multiple photos. You can create Twitter will automatically create a collage from up to four photos. You can share up to four photos in a single tweet. And once again, I don't believe it affects the character count.
This is funny because you think about it and, when you look at all the other services out there, the idea of sharing, I guess not Instagram, but, Facebook, Google+, Flickr, the idea of sharing multiple photos in one go as like a kind of mini album is just there. It's just available. But Twitter has been so Spartan about everything. This is like huge, right? Does this mean that Foursquare is going to have to change because you can now take four Foursquare photos with every check-in because you can post it to Twitter? Or, Instagram will I take multiple check-in, multiple photos to post to Twitter? I don't know. But I don't know. It's kind of funny to think that Twitter's letting four images happen and that's a big deal. Because it really is a big deal. It's just kind of silly that it's a big deal given what the technology does allow for.
Yeah, I mean, it really is more of a no-brainer, right? And also the ability to be able to leverage the text, the characters you have for real context rather than having to leverage it for tagging people, for photos. Really what they should do is, determine a way in which your app mentions don't necessarily have to count against your characters as well, too.
Should be an option, right? Like, you should be able, like, if you really need to, if you're in, like, the middle of Syria and you're tweeting and you want to call attention to somebody, then, yeah, let that hang out in your 140-character count because you're going to be using text messages to send that tweet instead of just, the online service because the internet's all screwed up there. But if you're here and, you have the ability to, I'm going to tag six people in there. What I'm a little worried about is what's happened with Instagram where I'm tagging a million photos that I'm not actually in. Instagram is becoming kind of like Facebook where, oh, here's a picture of something I think you'll like. I'll tag you. And that's the one thing I can see. But Twitter's already using the crowd to do some stuff. Like right now, I don't know if you guys see it, but whenever you two follow somebody, I get a notification from the Twitter app telling me that you guys just followed somebody because they think I probably want to follow them too.
Yeah.
So they're using this kind of crowd thing, using this kind of like tagging idea to get more activity going on the site. And I think it'll work. I think when you're tagged in a tweet, you're going to hop in there, and there's less barrier for you. If there's less barrier for you to be tagged in a tweet, it's going to be helpful.
Yeah, yeah. I like the idea of the at. I would love for the at replies or the at mentions to not be add to your character count. I mean, I can see why they would want to limit that, because then you possibly get into like sort of spamming things.
Yeah, you get at mentioned everybody on your situation, but, and then suddenly everybody's a private user and no one's communicating.
But what's frustrating for me is that a lot of the people that I know have these handles that are super long. You know, unless you joined Twitter in the first couple of years, you can't have one of those nice short Twitter handles, and so all that
I know
stuff...
I've been typing Mr. Baby Man, and my thumbs get tired by typing. Like, I don't know why you can't just have seven letters like me.
But you get my point. So yeah. It'd be nice if those didn't count towards your final,
or at least if they limited to a certain number of at mentions in a tweet, right?
So. Right. Even like people who got there earlier, like I'm still typing in D E V I N D R A.
Yeah,
like it's still like a lot. Like I wish people had nicknames. You know what I mean?
Nicknames for their nicknames for their
exactly nicknames. So I want to type in at Dev, and you know, our buddy would get it. Or I want to type in at Toast. Like I should be able to make nicknames, like when I make aliases on email. But that's going to be years before Twitter even thinks about doing that.
So let's talk about this next story that you brought to our attention, Dwayne. This is from NPR. So you, what is it? So you think you're smarter than a CIA agent.
Right. So like, you know, we're here talking about Twitter. We know Twitter's used for these revolutions and stuff like that. And, you know, it used to be that the CIA was focused. We talked about this a little bit last week with Greg. The CIA was focused on knowing what's going on in the world. Back in the 90s, during Kosovo, the president actually called CNN to figure out what was going on in the world. Like, hey, have the bombs dropped? CNN says yes. But today it's kind of all about Twitter, right? Twitter is the thing that's saying, hey, you know, there's a shots fired in this area. There's a mass shooting, God forbid. Or there's you know, bombs exploded here, or the revolution is happening in this place around the world. Twitter is doing all that. And a couple of years ago, these psychologists basically said, you know what? We're going to take a page out of fiction, and we're going to see how good individuals are at predicting, not even just telling us what the world is saying, but predicting what the world is saying. So they started this whole plan where they got a bunch of people, and they'd give them these sort of a multiple choice options based on numbers and averages and things like that. And over time, they basically trained them, multiple people around the world, around the country rather. They trained them to be able to answer questions by just looking things up on Google and applying a little math to it.
Well, this is something like they ask these people these questions, and I don't know if they ask them in particular how they go about arriving at the answers. Like the woman they interviewed in this NPR, she just looked things up on Google, but I don't think that was a like something.
Well, in
that
the beginning, she
them.
Said she just got questions that were about numbers.
Yeah,
right. That was the weird thing. So she just got questions that were like, "Hey, between these two things, what do you think? Like 1, 2, 3, or 4, whatever." But then you're right. They just went up to her and they said, "Okay, what do you think about this? Why don't you take a look on Google, see what you think?" And they're using kind of like the law of averages, the smartness of the crowd, to basically figure out how the tie is going to turn. They use a great example of a dead ox at a circus or a fair about 100 years ago. And
this is the origin of the whole concept of wisdom of the crowds.
Exactly. And basically, there was this ox, and it was on a scale, but the scale was obscured, so people didn't know how much it weighed, and it was dead, so it wasn't moving. And they had people guess the weight of this dead ox. People guessed, and people were all over the map.
Yeah.
But when the
statistician Francis Galton.
Say his name again?
Francis Galton.
Francis Galton, when he got there and he took a look at the guesses that had been written down, he realized how all across the world they were, but he began to average them. And when he came to the average number, it was 1 pound more than the actual weight of the oxen. So there are people who are way on the fringes, but most people kind of have, like, between the entire crowd, there's kind of this idea that, hey, there are certain things that we all get together, we all understand together, and the average of these different opinions usually lands on what we would define as the truth. So what they're doing is they're using, you know, 200, 300 people around the country who, and this, the woman that they interviewed was a pharmacist. She's not in the intelligence community at all. But they, you know, they get people who are, you know, relatively bright, but, you know, more importantly, they're just people who are willing to partake in the study, and they get them to answer questions. So these people rightly predicted the Syrian war, the invasion of Crimea by Putin and Russia. And these are things that the CIA didn't get right. And one of the problems the CIA faces is that today, a lot of stuff that's going on in the world that we have to think about isn't happening with people who look like the majority American, right? So you can't necessarily put a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in the middle of Syria and say, hey, figure out what's going on covertly. That's an issue. So they're using this technology, or they're developing this technology, this kind of crowdsourced technology, to kind of figure it out based on the aggregate opinion of multiple people looking at the same thing. All these different perspectives tend to distill into something that's quite useful. And it's, to me, it's mind-bogglingly awesome and also kind of embarrassingly obvious. But still, yeah. It makes me just think the CIA is I don't know how useful the CIA is anymore.
You're right. Well, what's interesting about this also is that there are people whose average predictions tend to average higher than many of the other people in this group, and they call them super predictors. And it makes me wonder if the CIA is covertly contacting these super predictors and asking them to
help out.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. One of the big things about this that makes it work is that these people are anonymous. They remain anonymous. So if you're a CIA director, let's suppose you were an analyst like what's it called? Like Jack from a Clear and Present Danger, right? Uh-huh. You're an analyst. You got nothing to lose when you say that the Red October is defecting, because you're an analyst. You're not going any lower.
Right.
But when Jack gets pushed up and up and up, and finally he's the director of the CIA, just like the CEO of any company or the COO, making a prediction comes with a lot of political backlash if you're wrong. When you've got nothing to lose, you will be honest about your prediction. But when you're running something, or when you're expected to make the right prediction, and your reputation is on the line, then you're going to be more conservative about your predictions. You're going to make less predictions because you don't want your margin of error to be so large. The crowd destroys that. By making the crowd just kind of all say whatever they think and distilling it into an average, you get a response that no one is completely culpable for. So if everyone's wrong, then something's really off the system. But right now, over the last several years, nothing has been completely off. So part of the big thing is not identifying these super people, avoiding the American predilection toward individuality in order to get the right answer. Because individuals, when asked a bunch of times, will again sort of get tied to their ego. I don't want to be wrong, so I'm going to say what I think is the safe thing to say. Mm-hmm. When in fact, they may have an idea that seems out of the scope of everybody else, but it is the right idea based on just everything that they've known so far. So it's one of the crazy things about this. Like, you really have to focus on not individualism. There's no superhero here. It's about a system of individuals, working together as a crowd to really make these predictions work. And that, to me, is mind-boggling.
But there's also nothing to say that the CIA doesn't currently, you know, leverage part of this as another factor, right? Assuming that they're listening to all channels, this is another place to, you know, keep
yes
an eye.
And no. I mean, this is done independently by some psychologists. They spoke to the CIA after they started doing this, so maybe the CIA is doing this. But the bureaucracy of the CIA, and especially because, like, these guys have been right on a couple things over the last several years, yeah, and the CIA was still wrong about so many things. So there's something wrong in the bureaucracy where they're not taking this data, they're not weighting this data properly. Then if they're getting it, like you say, Tosin, they're not weighting it with the appropriate gravity. God, I didn't mean to use all those kind of weight-based things, but they're not taking it seriously enough to include it into what they say to the national, you know, security advisor and things like that. And that's, you know, I mean, like, how can you blame them? Hey, we got a whole bunch of crackpot people and scientists telling us that this kind of, like, weird Asimov-based psychohistory thing is the way that the world's going to go. We can predict the future because a whole bunch of random people say this and that. CIA can't do that. It's too they've got too much writing on it. Part of it is the fact that the CAA is the CAA. They're taking this data and they're like looking at it very skeptically because they've got these methods that they've been using for the last 60 years. And even though they're not necessarily working, they're not going to go astray because going astray is more dangerous than saying, oh, the system failed. No, I didn't fail as the director. The system failed. And that's part of the issue.
Let's move on here. To most consumers, it's common sense that you can make a backup copy of media that you own. But in the UK, this is currently illegal.
It's also legal in the US.
Yeah, well, the UK is changing their laws. They're starting in July, people are going to be free to make copies of DVDs, CDs, and other types of media as long as it's for personal use. The UK's Intellectual Property Office writes, copyright law is being changed to allow you to make personal copies of media you've bought for private purposes such as format shifting or backup. The changes means you'll be able to copy a book or film you purchase for one device onto another without infringing copyright. And what's fascinating to me about this sets a precedent.
It is. It's an international precedent on intellectual property, which is usually dealt with from an international scale. So this is actually huge. Because in the US, while you can rip your CDs into MP3s, the MPAA, which is stronger than the RIAA, the guys in charge of the movies, don't let you take your DVDs and Blu-rays and turn them into, you know, digital copies. So Andy's whole talk about a digital copy before was really frustrating because he bought a disc and he couldn't get the digital version. In the UK, you buy a disc, getting the digital version isn't an issue. No matter how you do it, as long as you use it for yourself and you're not sharing it on the internet via torrents or whatever, it's all yours and you're just consuming it. You bought it once, you can run it everywhere. In the US, it's against the law to take any kind of like DVD or Blu-ray media and convert it to, say, work on your iPad because you're going to be on a plane later. Or because, let's face it, no laptop you buy today has a disk drive built into it. So you're kind of stuck. But in the UK, they're setting it – I mean, I think we'd all agree that they're setting it right, which is a precedent. And hopefully the US can follow. But let's face it, the US is a little slow on these things.
And not to mention the it's also a precedent. Like the rules that they're setting here for DVDs and CDs could – there's no reason in theory that they can't apply towards Blu-rays or any other media.
Right. They're pushing it basically for the future. Now, granted, a lot of what we're seeing now is digital downloads, digital rentals. Digital rentals are still very expensive compared to normal rentals. You go to Redbox, you get a disc for $1 a day. You go to Amazon, you get a movie for 24 hours. You're paying $4 for it. So the idea that you can kind of just buy a disc and use it and use it anywhere, or any way you buy it, you can convert it. That is a precedent, and it can move forward to the future depending on how people plan on using, consuming media. It's definitely huge, especially with 4K media having the delivery problem. We all know that 4K is, the visuals are 4 times the size of 1080p HD. So transferring that over a network is problematic. A disc really is right now, the only real way to get your hands on it. But frankly, you should be able to convert some version of that onto your iPad, even if it takes up the whole thing. Yeah.
All right, let's take a break here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the Audible book that, Dwayne, you would like to recommend this week is Foundation by Isaac Asimov.
Right. This book. I mean, have you guys read The Foundation?
I have to admit that I have not.
Okay. If you like science fiction, you will like The Foundation. If you've seen Star Trek and like it, if you've seen Star Wars and liked it, it is based on The Foundation. It's a funny title because it is the foundation of science fiction as most young people know it today. And basically the premise is from Audible. For 12,000 years, the Galactic Empire has ruled supreme. Now it's dying. But only Harry Sheldon, the creator of the revolutionary science, Psychohistory, can see into the future, to a dark age of ignorance, barbarism, and warfare that'll last 30,000 years. To preserve knowledge and save mankind, Sheldon must gather the best minds in the Empire, both scientists and scholars, and bring them to a bleak planet on the edge of the galaxy to serve as a beacon of hope for future generations. So what's interesting about this story and how it ties in today to today is that this idea of this guy who could see the future, he saw the future through this thing called psychohistory, whereupon he would use the relevant zeitgeist of humanity, how a whole bunch of people and how they felt, you know, right now, to figure out how the future is going to be. Not unlike this story about the CIA and the predictions that other people can make that these psychologists are using. And it's kind of interesting to see that, you know, he basically understood that there was going to be a fall in this empire. Mm-hmm. We hear all this doom and gloom stuff about America all the time. You've got Putin rising, you've got China rising, you got all this stuff. So I just thought it was a relatively interesting story. If you haven't read it, it's really clever. A lot of it happens in dialogues. A lot of it happens in little talks between two or three characters, as opposed to space opera kind of stuff. But it's brilliant and it's smart, and it's part of a trilogy that basically put together the foundation for a lot of the sci-fi that we watch today. When you watch Battlestar Galactica and the ships jump, uh-huh. Foundation was the first one to do that.
No.
When you watch Star Wars and you have Coruscant, the Foundation invented the idea of the city planet. The idea of, you know, the iPhone and the iPad and all these embedded technologies that we have, they call them nucleics in the Foundation. But really, like, a big piece of what's going on is the people who can make these electronic devices that do all this stuff is the nation that runs the galaxy. And that really is what's happening, right? It might be that we build in China, but it's still all designed in America. So it's definitely something that you can read, you know, from, you know, 70, 80 years ago, and it ties into our technological life now. This is the guy who invented the term roboticist or robotics. You know, he saw the future. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that, you know, so much of what he saw has come to pass without even, like, claiming, hey, this is going to be the future. He was just trying to tell a story.
Huh. It sounds like a fascinating story. It's on my list of classic literature that I need to catch up on for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Tosin, have you read any Asimov?
Only bits and pieces. It is also on my list. It's actually one of the books that I have, you know, one of the series that I have right here. So I will get through it.
It's good. He's also doing, obviously, like, he's on this iRobot stuff. If you're not into sort of like a whole long book that's just one big story, because, I mean, let's face it, a lot of what we do now is like short stories and, like, you know, small podcasts, things like that. He's also got this iRobot stuff, which is a whole bunch of, let's call them vignettes, an anthology of short stories about robotics and how they work. So however you get to Asimov, it's all on Audible. It's all good. Listen to it on your way to work, especially like Tosin, your drive isn't too long. Maybe, you know, a chapter or a drive is going to be super easy. So check it out. It's going to be good.
To download that free audiobook, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can quit and keep Foundation for free. Going to that site helps us on the show. So again, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Amazon is on fire and wants you to be as well. Take a listen to this and come on back.
It's a fire. These dreams have passed me by. This salvation I desire keeps getting me down. 'Cause we need to recognize mistakes for time and again. So let it be known for what we see no reason.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakan. Well, we've been waiting for it for some time now, and now Amazon is finally ready to make its play for the living room, and it's called Fire TV. It's an Android-driven platform. It's a slim black plastic box that has a quad-core CPU with the full 2 gigs of RAM. Shorter than a dime, it's got a small selection of ports, including HDMI, optical, audio, and Ethernet. It ships with Amazon Instant Video, Hulu, Netflix, YouTube, Plex, Vivo, Watch ESPN. It's got voice search via a mic in the Bluetooth remote. Free time mode, which is a kid-friendly mode with safe content. And the voice search is augmented to allow for simpler searches. Free time unlimited is even more restricted, but it's so children don't have to ask parents for permission. And it's got, it also plays video games. Oh, this is the exciting part too. So, it's bringing gaming to the set-top box with the, it's actually a video game player, and they have developers like 2K, Double Fine, and Ubisoft, amongst others, bringing their games to the platform. The biggest game, of note so far, is definitely Minecraft. You'll be able to play the games with the remote that comes with it, but the big news is that Amazon's going to be selling a game controller accessory, which is not unlike an Xbox controller, but it's got a standard set of Android buttons on its face and media controls on one edge. And to prove it's serious about gaming, Amazon scored a number of exclusive titles for Fire TV, like Sev-Zero, which is built by Amazon's, by the recently recently formed Amazon Game Studios.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that kind of crazy? We're living in this world where every week we're talking about an acquisition.
Yeah.
And Amazon builds a game studio. Like, there may be an acquisition in there somewhere, but the fact of the matter is, it wasn't a high-profile one, and Amazon didn't go out and kind of seek, you know, hey, Android developer, we're going to go buy you or anything like that. Like, they really just kind of built this. There's a lot of building from the ground up here, and that's kind of exciting.
We
kind of
knew that this was a precursor to a move like this with the Fire TV.
Yeah, I mean, a year ago or so, we were talking about a possible Amazon phone. We were talking about, and I remember mentioning an Amazon, you know, maybe it wasn't a phone, maybe it was some sort of like iPod Touch kind of device, you know, like not like cellularly connected, but allowed you to see some stuff, get to your content over Wi-Fi. And it seems that, those rumors were talking about the kind of hardware they put into this device, which is effectively a high-end Android phone, you know, quad core, 2 gigs of RAM, you know, not worried about battery life, that kind of thing. But like the Apple TV, which is also used to be a relatively high-end Apple phone, doesn't have a screen, and you just plug it in and it does what it has to do. The Apple TV is an A5X processor. It's a single core A5. The A5 is what ran the iPhone 4S and the Apple iPad 3. So this is like miles ahead of that right now, but there hasn't been an update to that. We'll see what happens. And you know, it's got all the stuff you would imagine someone would need to have in order to compete in the set-top space. But on top of that, it's got this gaming thing, which I think all of us have been interested in, especially since the Ouya showed up on Kickstarter.
Yeah, I think one of the big things about it is really just Amazon getting into this space, especially given that they're such a big content provider. And you know, for consumers out here, it's just good to have more competition, right?
Yes.
It gives more variety, and hopefully we'll see a bit more innovation. As far as, like, would I purchase this right now? I'm not so sure. It's nice having that Amazon have that play, but I already have so many other devices that do quite a lot of that, and I don't know if it's the right thing for me just yet. But we'll see what happens with it.
I mean, that's, like, the big question right now is with so many other players in the market, including Apple TV and Roku and Chromecast – what will set Amazon apart?
Yeah, they're fighting for budget, and they're fighting for ports and space. I've shown you guys my setup here at home.
Yeah.
It's one that doesn't have a lot of space for extra stuff. I've pretty carefully chosen things. If I had to think about it today, I would say my Ouya would probably go, my Amazon thing would show up. But the thing that doesn't all that work for me right now is an Apple TV. And then when it comes to Amazon, I use my actual television set because it has that built in, or I use my PS3. This device does a lot of that stuff, and the graphics on the games aren't quite as good as a PS3, but they're definitely better than most mobile platforms I've seen so far. Amazon's got to figure out a way, and I think the gaming is the way, to usurp one of those HDMI ports. On a TV like mine, you've got 4 or 5 HDMI ports. Most TVs have like 3. They've got to figure out a way to say, hey, look, I know you got a smart TV. That's all they sell these days, but you want to use my box because my experience is better. So the Netflix has to be tight. The Hulu has to be tight. Amazon Instant Video, obviously, that'll be great. We saw the kind of cover flow layout. It's all image focused. And what's really interesting is that if you're into the kind of performance and seamlessness that you're used to when it comes to just going on the web and doing stuff, you'll find that for the first time, I think, in a set-top box, you have that with the Amazon box. Whether I'm on my PS3 or my Apple TV or asking my TV, my television set, it's a Sony, to get into Crackle or whatever, there's always loading time. Everything we saw from this launch was that the 2 gigs of RAM, the quad-core CPU, the software they've built, it happens very quickly. When you say, I want to watch a show, it just starts. Right now on my TV, it's like Amazon's figuring out your connection speed. Amazon's loading the show. Here you go. There's like spinning wheels and all that stuff. That doesn't happen on the Kindle Fire TV. It doesn't. It just shows up and it just goes. And if that's the standard that we have to be used to, that we get to be used to with the Amazon box, everyone else is going to have to step up. And I'm not sure that their systems are all designed to do that. I mean, I was very, very impressed. And granted, you know, Amazon was putting on the show. It could have had a server in the next room serving the content. But it showed up quickly. It showed up crazily. And the best part was the voice controls were fairly reliable. There was one stutter. He had to repeat something twice. But for the most part, the idea of having a Bluetooth remote that's going to transfer your voice through the remote into there is kind of nice. The only problem with that is that if you guys have a Harmony device, it's not going to work with that.
Right, unless there's a way to tweak that PS3.
The PS3 adapter would have to be tweaked to support the Amazon, the Amazon hardware. Right now, the PS3 adapter doesn't even work with the PS4. Logitech is still trying to focus that and try to make that work. But this
Amazon device is not vaporware, futureware. It's available now for $100 at Amazon.
Yeah, it's great. It's $100 for the device that comes with the Bluetooth remote control. The remote control is about a little bit bigger than the Apple TV remote control, but it's because it has the microphone in it. It's pretty useful. $40 for the game controller. Mm-hmm. So you're paying 40% of the device of the price of the device for the game controller, which is a big game controller. You guys saw that picture? It is not a small game controller.
It's comparable to the Ouya's game controller.
Right, but it also looks like it has some good functionality. What I do like about the Ouya controller is the touch screen. That's really quite sweet when you're trying to get things done. I don't know. I haven't played with the Amazon one yet, but I do know that it seems to have a lot of media controls just sitting on it. But the idea that I can sit there and have one box and play some games with some friends right from it, that's great. And frankly, mobile games are relatively casual. If they're hitting, they said they hit the PSP, so the PlayStation Portable quality, not quite the PS Vita, which is the current portable device PlayStation sells, Sony sells. That's pretty good quality for a phone. It's pretty good quality for your TV. They're taking something that's supposed to be on a small screen and putting it up to 1080p. That's not bad.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm still on the fence. You know, I have a Chromecast, but I've never opened it because...
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the Sony Blu-ray player that I got around the same time at Christmas had all of the functionality that I was looking for in the Chromecast. It had all, basically set-top box functionality complete with its own sort of media home.
Yeah, so let's talk about these devices that are out there. Right now you have the Apple TV, which is kind of like catch-all. You know, it does all these things. Like, you know, you can get to the Apple ecosystem. You can get to Netflix. Hulu Plus is there, and everything but Amazon really is there from like the basic players. You have the Chromecast, which is, to me, is interesting because I don't use the Chromecast super often. What I use it for is to cast my phone or to cast the Chrome browser. So I don't have an Apple computer. I have an Apple computer, but I don't have an Apple laptop. So when I'm on my laptop, I'm on a Windows based HP Envy, and I'm doing my things left and right, and I'm always on Chrome, so I can push it up to the screen pretty easily from the Chromecast. Chromecast is smart because it can tell the TV, hey, look, he wants to be on my channel, switch to HDMI, whatever I am, and boom, you're there. That's cool. But I'm not using the Chromecast for things like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, because frankly, I don't know what supports it. Every once in a while, I'll open up an app on my phone, and I'll see that it has a Chromecast logo. But it's very unclear what it supports because it doesn't have a great interface in and of itself. It essentially is your phone's interface and the ability to push it out there, which is what Google was looking for $35. What the PS3, PS4, Xbox 360, and Xbox One offer is kind of a big solution. Turn it on, wait till it all loads up, and get in there. With the Xbox, my biggest problem is I have to pay $60 just to get the services I already pay for. That's a problem for me.
I'm predicting that that's going to go away because it's just bullshit why you should have to do that.
I mean, you said it. It's crazy that I have to pay $60 to Microsoft to get online, but that $60 is constantly going toward funding content. So ESPN3 just showed up on Xbox a few years ago, and that was cool. Why? Because they had the funding from my $60 subscription to get it done. But I've since turned it off because the box is collecting dust because most of my gaming happens on the PS3. And the reason why that happens is because it played a Blu-ray out the box. PlayStation has a Plus service now. You can pay $60 a year. You'll get a free game a month, which is kind of tight. Yada, yada, yada. What Amazon is offering here is the price of an Apple TV. And frankly, you know, they're Johnny-come-lately to this space. They put their stuff on everything else, Roku, whatever. It's the price of an Apple TV, the price of a high-end Roku, three times the price of a Chromecast, but they've offered superior speed. They've offered they have a TV service that doesn't require Amazon Prime, which they're going to be rolling out. You can get to everything you want to get. It's a beautiful interface. What they're really offering, though, that's different is this whole gaming aspect. And frankly, I think we've been missing it from some of the other guys.
That's going to be something to watch.
Right, because, I mean, the Ouya showed up with an Android-based gaming platform that is okay. It's a little confusing how you get your games, how you emulate this, how you emulate that. Yeah. I doubt you'll be able to emulate or hack with the Fire TV. I mean, it's Amazon's ecosystem. They're going to add things. It's going to be about as tightly wound as the Apple TV. But Amazon's committed to not closing their ecosystem. So there's likely, you know, if Apple wanted, you know, they could probably strike a deal with Amazon to sell content on there. But, you know, that's not what Apple does. One of the big things about this, too, is that with the gaming, the idea that it's pretty casual, pretty easy to set up, and you know that box is fast. You're not worried about it. Frankly, Apple's on the A7 chip right now. The current chip inside the Apple TV 3 is an A5X, the single-core A5, when the normal A5, I think, is dual-core. So they've been hanging back on delivering new hardware. I suspect that we might see something in June during WWDC, maybe one more thing. Maybe it'll show up in October this year when they drop either an A7, the current iPhone 5S's chip, or an A8, the iPhone 6's chip, which we presume, into a device which will give it crazy power, and that would really compete with what Amazon's got going. But the fact of the matter is Amazon's doing a leapfrog in getting into this late. They're jumping over everybody else and saying we're the new standard for the price. And for the content, I mean, it's a pretty sweet deal. And everybody who was in that room, every single reporter in that room, got a new Kindle Fire TV.
Oh, nice.
Which is more than nice. Like, oh, it's cool. I'm a reporter. I get to play with this thing. It really shows that Amazon is committed to the product being successful.
Yeah.
And they're not afraid of the product failing. That's a big deal. I mean, when the iPad came out, people got to go into a back room and play with some iPads, but they didn't walk away with one. And Amazon's saying, look, it's not a question of control conditions. It's not a question of we have a whole bunch of people looking over your shoulder as you tap the few apps we've got available on this thing. No, take this home. This is the final product. This isn't a beta or an alpha or anything.
Right.
This is it. We're done. We are going to ship them today. And that's like one of the big things that everybody says about everybody, like these products. Like Apple's very good about telling you price and availability. And many of the other manufacturers, especially when the Surface came out, queasy on price, didn't tell you when the date was going to be. They were all about the announcement. Amazon stepping up to Apple and saying, look, we're as good as you are when it comes to making this hardware. We've got our Kindle Fire. the 7-8 inch tablet that you had to copy with your iPad mini. And sure, we're copying you with the set-top box, but the fact is, we're going to be toe-to-toe right there and basically say, we're dropping it today. It's available today. Yeah. And all of you scrutinizing, super hardcore critical reporters, you can have it right now. Go home, write about it after a couple of days. You will be impressed. To me, that's a rock out with your, you know, whatever out, balls to the wall. Well, I mean, that's pretty bold in tech. It's pretty bold in tech. And only, and Bezos wasn't even there. It's almost like he said, I'm going to drop the mic and leave you with my friend. He can tell you about it. Like, it was, it's just very, it's very strong. Strong PR, strong marketing, strong product launch.
Yeah. This is very, very typical of what we've come to expect from Amazon now. One last thing I want to say about the gaming aspect, and that is in relation to the Ouya. Like, the Ouya was an ambitious idea, but unfortunately a non-starter because of the limited processor in that device. But and hearing that the Amazon's got a
quad core
CPU processor is encouraging. But the thing that would have really made me happy, and something that Amazon is entirely capable of doing, I would have bought one immediately, would be streaming gaming, like on live style.
That is interesting. I don't, you know, it's unclear because they didn't talk about storage in this box. And I think storage is something that Roku and Apple TV have made kind of moot in terms of talking about these devices. They didn't talk about storage, which makes me believe that there may well be a significant amount of streaming gaming going on to begin with. But that's a very valid, point. For me, the thing that's keeping me back is, you know, I've part of it is, you know, and the app, you know, Amazon allows you to take a picture with your smartphone, put it on your Amazon cloud storage and show it up on your screen and things like that. What Apple's got going for it now is the direct integration. I took a picture at a party today. I left my TV on by accident. The Apple TV is showing me those images from that party that I was taking today because it's managing my activity. That kind of integration is classy, is cool. Is, you know, that's the no-brainer thing. Amazon's got to be able to break away from that and say, hey, look, you want what I got. But yeah, in addition to this, the gaming thing, one of the things about the gaming thing is that in addition to the using the controller to control games, the remote control is meant to also allow you to control games. So if you don't want to spring for the $40, you can start out playing games with the remote control. They also said that they're going to release an app for your smartphone that allows you to control the games as well. Now, as a person who doesn't really love games on my touchscreen devices, I don't know how well it's going to work. But the fact is, they're Amazon. They're just giving you options. Interesting from a company that, you know, frankly, from the beginning, they've always kind of like said, we're going to be like Netflix. We're going to be everywhere. Every device we can be on, we're going to be on. Even with my Apple TV, I can stream. I can get Amazon on my iPad and push that over to my Apple TV. So there is some of that. But I'm excited about this.
Me too. All right, moving on here. Last week, Mozilla employees across the web called for the removal of their new CEO, Brendan Eich, who in 2008 donated $1,000 to support Prop 8, which was a California ballot proposition that aimed to ban gay marriage in California. As a result of this development, Firefox users who go to OkCupid.com are now being greeted by the following protest message landing page. Quote, equality for gay relationships is personally important to many of us here at OkCupid, but it's professionally important to the entire company. OkCupid is for creating love. Those who seek to deny love and instead enforce misery, shame, and frustration are our enemies, and we wish them nothing but failure. If you want to keep... Yeah. Harsh. They say, if you want to keep using Firefox, the link at the bottom will take you through the site. However, we urge you to consider different software for accessing OkCupid. You can still access the service via Firefox after scrolling past the note and clicking through. But here's a company actively discouraging traffic for political reasons. Have you ever heard of anything like this from any modern tech company?
Well, I know that Tim Cook openly said that he was, you know, he openly mentioned that the whole game Eric's thing is a good thing. And he wasn't doing it necessarily as Apple. I think he was doing it as Tim Cook, the most powerful homosexual in the world. But to see a company do this, it is, you know, let's go back to the phrase I used before. It's balls out, balls to the wall. Yeah. But it's also business tends to stay away. At least most businesses tend to stay away intelligently from politics. In this case, it seems very much like OkCupid's like, hey, it's going to be the kind of attention that we're going to get attention from this, and it's going to be positive attention from our perspective, and that's fine. But it also, you know, they are saying straight up, we want Firefox to fail as long as it's run by a person who is anti-gay. And I think for a lot of millennials today, the gay rights movement is meaningful as perhaps the civil rights movement was for those people back in the 60s, because today's millennials want to be doing meaningful things, and that struggle is the big parts of that struggle have passed, the civil rights struggle, and this is the civil rights struggle of today. It is a civil rights issue for many people. So the people running OkCupid are they're focused on connecting people who want to hook up and, emotionally hook up, not just sexually hook up. And it's going to get in the way of their bottom line.
Yeah.
But the political tide has turned against a lot of this anti-gay marriage, gay whatever stuff. And they're riding that tide. And it seems to me like a savvy PR and business decision, regardless of the social implications.
Yeah, it is interesting mixing work with politics, because we've seen many, many occasions where organizations have been burned in doing so, but mm-hmm. It does seem like the sort of thing that is occurring a lot more, right? Google's Doodle, although that's not one-on-one in sort of like a boycott.
No,
it is
right. Google's Doodle was like, but just it to was remind a, people, Google had a rainbow doodle
during the Sochi Olympics.
Yes, to represent pride,
right?
Gay pride, because the Sochi Olympics was taking place in a country that has laws against open homosexuality. And that is a big thing. That was big. Although Google didn't tell the world that they hoped that people who are against gay love should fail.
Exactly.
Which is huge.
It's not a direct competition. But it does show that more and more organizations are sort of taking a stand. And I guess it's going to be something that we may see develop more, but I don't know. It seems a little weird to me, because I've just seen so many places be burned, and I wonder
who are you alienating as a customer? If you've got customers already that are, I mean, granted, it's OkCupid, right? So it's about finding love. It's about whatever. They can't really miss by trying to open up the wider funnel of who can love whom, right? But if you were, like, let's say the company you work for, a box.com, trying to tell people, hey, we're for this or against this, there are plenty of organizations out there run by people who may not be interested in that kind of, interaction from you. There are plenty of people who would be like, hey, I don't want to roll with Disney anymore, Andy, if Disney made some big stand about this as well.
So or it's like Chick-fil-A or, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Right. So like these companies that, I mean, granted, the thing about Firefox is interesting is that, this CEO, he made a donation of $1,000. That's not a crazy amount of money.
No.
It's not it's not like he took capital out of the company to drop $50,000 on this thing. I mean,
And this was before he was the CEO.
Yeah, it was before he was the CEO. So it was a while ago. But the idea here is that he didn't say, on behalf of Firefox, I deem this. You know what I mean? He said, hey, for me, I'm going to go against this whole gay marriage thing. I'm going to support Prop 8. Mm-hmm. I got my reasons, whatever they are. Exposing him like this seems, I don't know if it seems unfair. Granted, like, these kind of contributions are public for a reason. You got to understand people's motives and whatever. But it's just very interesting to see that, it wasn't exactly something he was running about as a business. He was doing as an individual. And his business is definitely getting getting paid for this. It'll be interesting to see what happens to him if the board asks him to step down or something like that. Does this mean that if you're on the Tor browser, which I feel like uses Mozilla as its platform base, that you're going to run into this as well? So you're looking to maintain your privacy about whatever you're doing, and then you run into this, you're like, oh, I guess I can't, you know, all that stuff. I mean, the interesting thing also is that OkCupid's not saying you just can't use it. There are plenty of times when I open up a web browser to a website and it says, we don't support this, it's not going to work. Right.
They're saying we'd rather you didn't.
Right. So
they're telling you why.
Exactly. It's a very political statement. It's like, you can use this if you're a jerk, is what they're saying, right? Like, that's kind of what they're doing. So they have the potential to be a lot more alienating than they think. It'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Let's move on to some Microsoft news. Microsoft last week announced Office for iPad, which brings Word, PowerPoint, and Excel to tablets. As with the iPhone version that they'd previously released, the apps are free to download, and you can view documents and give presentations without a paid subscription. You need to sign in with a OneDrive or SharePoint account to retrieve those documents. If you want to edit a doc or create something from scratch, you'll need an Office 365 subscription. Apple confirmed that it will take the usual 30% cut of all Office 365 subscriptions purchased from any Office for iPad app. So that means
that if you have an Office 365 subscription, Apple's not getting anything. But if you get that subscription while you're on the app, Apple gets it.
Gets 30% cut.
It doesn't really affect you.
No.
Because you're still paying the same price. Although in Pandora, I wonder if it is the same price. Because I know in Pandora,
but essentially,
it's not the same price.
Microsoft's giving up 30% of their business to users who subscribe on Apple.
And we know this because, so like, here's the thing. Again, Pandora, it's $48 if you get it on Apple. It's $36 if you get it on the web, because Pandora's passing the cost of the Apple 30% onto you. But Microsoft CEO said something interesting today. He goes, we're going to focus on a world that is mobile first. That is cloud first.
Yep.
Or he might have said cloud first, mobile first. I don't know. It was a paraphrase. But that is an interesting way to look at the world when your company has been in charge of desktops for 25 years. So it's interesting to see that. And I wonder how that's really going to work for them. Microsoft is definitely pivoting. It's pivoting under this new CEO. And I think that's a key piece for what we want out of it. I mean, frankly, you know, the Xbox is kind of like becoming the only thing that people care about.
Microsoft
move this way.
Microsoft also had a build developer conference this week, and at the build developer conference, they announced had a couple of big announcements. They announced universal Windows apps for developers, which essentially allows developers to create a single app that works across Windows phones, tablets, PC, and the Xbox One. It makes it easy for developers to implement as much of the code can be reused across the different platforms.
They've been promising this for a long time. I'm so glad it's possible. That's the only way they're going to be able to compete.
Right. And the fascinating thing about this for me is that this is something we've heard Windows talk about for years. For years, their sort of long-term plan had been to unify the code across the devices, so it's one sort of so the developers can create one, you know, set of code instructions for all of these, and that can be used universally across all the devices. And to me, that's incredibly liberating for them, because it allows the functionality across the devices, and it's a boon. It's going to be a boon to consumers. You may have to, as a consumer, you may have to pay for access to the different platforms separately, but at the heart of it, the code will be the same.
Yeah, it's interesting, because you think about, you know, Steve Ballmer just got out of office, right?
Yeah.
Satya Nadella is definitely in charge now, but this stuff all began happening under Ballmer. So as much as we lament many of Ballmer's decisions, this is one of his. So just from a historical perspective, that's worth taking note of.
They also introduced Windows Phone 8.1, which is the newest version of their phone operating system, and that brings Cortana, which we talked about in an earlier episode of the drill down. Cortana is their female voice assistant like Siri, and you talk to her to search the web using Bing, send messages, add notes, set reminders, get directions.
Got so many syllables. Cortana. Ugh.
It's one more syllable than Siri. Yeah.
And Siri is too many syllables. I mean, granted, OK Google is also three syllables, but something about saying Cortana.
You just want your short phrases, like your Twitter handles.
Yes. I want to be like, I want to give the computer my own nickname, right? Or if I have to call it anything, I want to pull a Star Trek and be like, computer.
Computer.
And have it, like, right. Give me the little tritone and be like, oh, yeah, Major. Major Barrett, let's
go. One day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it'll have digitized legacy voice, the voice of Major Barrett for sure.
T, Earl Grey hot.
Yeah. Also, along with Cortana, one other addition to Windows Phone 8.1 is the WordFlow keyboard that comes with Windows Phone now gets gesture typing, which is similar to swipe in SwiftKey, and it works by just dragging your fingers from letter to type, which is something that I always wanted the iOS to adopt. I thought that would be something useful.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing, right? Like, swipe is cool. Everybody seems to like it who uses it. But, you know, even Google's moving toward this voice thing. I hate the voice thing because I'm, like, talking to a computer right now.
Yeah.
I really want it to be, like, Star Trek level before I talk to it on a regular basis because I just feel stupid. I can't get over myself. But, yeah, I mean, there's got to be something Apple could do to do that. But despite the lack of swipe, the lack of this Microsoft tech, Apple's still doing okay. So it's interesting because this is really the future, being able to just drag your finger across. And if you've ever ridden the subway with your phone in hand, especially as the phones are getting bigger and the other iPhones that are coming out this year are rumored to be even larger, getting your thumb across the screen is impossible. So it's really about this kind of drag technology, which Google is running and Microsoft is chasing.
Yeah. I mean, I use voice a lot, so I think that's still one of the best
ways. On your Apple device?
Yep, on my Apple device, sending text messages, scheduling appointments, meetings, reminders.
Is your car supported, or is that why you use it?
My car does not support it, but then again, I have it plugged into my speakers in my car, so all I have to do is hold down the button if I needed to. But I just use it throughout the day, throughout, like, my daily, you know, day. Even when I'm just walking around, like, often, you know, today I realized that there was something I needed to do for my trip to Boston coming up, and I was like, well, Siri, set a reminder for noon to call the hotel about it.
Oh, setting reminders is great. It's a text messaging that becomes a problem for
me. Oh, text message. Even you guys probably don't realize it, but there are often quite a lot of times when I'm text messaging you via Siri. It works really well for me.
Oh, I mean, I guess your accent is just that much better than ours. Because they always screw it up. And the worst part is, like, lately, I don't know what happened to – I got 7.1 and something happened. But, like, my autocorrect has been zany. So maybe I should move toward the voice. I just can't – I have a mental block with talking to not a person. I also, like, when I'm by myself, I don't use my voice. I guess I talk too much when I'm with other people and not enough when I'm alone.
It'll pass.
Siri's my friend.
I almost exclusively dictate text using voice nowadays.
Really? So the only thing that would make me do it more is if when I said thank you at the end of a Siri request, it worked. Because right now, because I'm talking to it, I think it's a person. I don't think it's a person, but it's in the back of my head. I'm just, yeah. You know, that's how I am. I'm like, Siri, set a reminder. She'll set a reminder. I'm like, thank you. Dwayne, I don't know what thank you means. Like, it's like it should know. It should know its own name. It should know how to say you're welcome. I shouldn't have to, like, augment my way of talking. You know what I mean?
You know, the only thing you have to really keep in mind is adding the punctuation marks verbally.
So period?
Yeah, you have to say yeah. Period.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I just really
you're
wish
welcome
I could.
To me, so,
she did?
Yeah, let me see if you can hear this. Thank you, Siri.
You don't need to thank me.
Okay, so do that. Well, that's interesting when you're playing with it. Do that by sending me a text message. ask it to send text message to me, or get in the voice command and send text message to me, whatever, and then say thank you when she said it's sent, and then see what happens, because that's the problem I run into.
Yeah, that I don't think that would work, because after you dictate it, it asks you to confirm, and then once you confirm it, it turns off the speaker. What right, I really wish problem. Is if you could, like, and you know, I know some of the later Nexus phones have this, where you can sort of initiate the voice controls without really doing much. But I did have a friend who it just kept on turning on constantly without unintentionally.
Yeah.
I can't wait till that point where it's where there's an option where you can kind of have it forever listen and it's not wasting your battery life. And you know,
that so would... that's what I want out of. And here's the thing, iOS is fantastic, but frankly, I would rather Siri be on my Mac. I want to be able to open the door, walk in the house, and ask the computer what I have up that evening. I just got home from work. Mm-hmm. I walk in. I'm like, you know, my Mac is sitting there. It's always on, and it's, you know, it's connected to speakers. I'll connect the microphone to it if need be, but I want to be able to walk in and say, "Hey Siri, I'm home. What's on the agenda for tonight? Dwayne, at 8 o'clock, you have the Drill Down podcast." Something like that. That's gonna make me use it, but I don't know. Like, yeah. That's kind of how maybe I'm spoiled brat. I don't know. I think that this whole OK Google thing is drawing me over toward Android more and more.
Yeah, but then you can't. Then well, I guess maybe later on when you go to baseball games, you can then interact.
Yeah, my iBeacon. I gotta carry two devices. It sucks. I need a third party device that's fast enough to virtualize Android and iOS.
I think it's coming. Didn't we report about that?
I've been excited about it since 2011 when Siri showed up.
I think we reported about that. It's coming eventually.
The idea that I could use the hardware in my machine, you know, like that would definitely spur me to get a MacBook Pro, right? Like I would just be like, okay, whatever, because the machine's got so much power that I could listen to everything and perform all these actions for me. It'd be great.
It's coming. All right, we're going to take one last break. And when we come back, the one day of the year you can absolutely believe everything you see on the web. So take a listen to this and come on back. Listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. Every year about this time, the first week of April, I have this sort of love-hate relationship with the web because I absolutely love tech news, but like when April 1st rolls around, nothing of any sort of good use gets done. Like you have to take the whole day off essentially and wait for the next day for any sort of substantial real tech news. And it's because of course the April Fool's tradition of April Fool's on the web. And this year was no exception. There were quite a few online pranks this year. Fortunately, I was actually working most of the time, so I didn't get a chance to experience a lot of this stuff. I think at the forefront, Google had a majority of the notable pranks. Their Google Maps featured a search for Pokemon, a global search for Pokemon. And I did get to try some of that. Basically, you open up Google Maps on your mobile device, and you can search for Pokemon globally around the world. I think I caught about 70 of them. So I know people who did, who were able to catch all 150 that they had available.
Gotta catch them all, Andy. I'm disappointed.
Yes. Google.
I was watching H2O just out of water, so I was fine.
What about you guys? What April Fool's pranks on the web did you experience and or enjoy?
Well, one of the good ones was Airbnb letting you rent out your desk and doing their new service. Did you guys see that one?
So that one actually confused me, because co-working is that. Co-working
actually does that. Growing. Yes.
Yeah, it's like, I was like, okay, you guys should probably actually do that instead of joking about it. For me, it was Google. Google Shelfie showed up, and the sad part is I immediately knew that it was fake. I got to say, I still watch 2013's April Fool's joke from Google, Gmail Blue. I watch that probably once every 2 months. It is by far the best in recent memory. I remember watching that for the first time, and frankly, I was like, oh, they've got some new functions. They got some new features. Blue is cool, whatever. And then, you know, at the end, I was just like giggling my head off because it was so ridiculous.
Yeah.
If you want to see a great one, listener, Google the term Gmail Blue, watch the YouTube video. It's about 3 minutes and 40-something seconds, and you'll be like, this is so ridiculous. It's awesome.
So with Google Shelfie is what? Google Shelfie was, or Gmail Shelfie was, where you can send your selfie to other Gmail users, a shareable selfie.
And it was a shareable selfie that could also be like your Google Mail theme,
yeah,
or something else. And it was kind of like, the minute you saw it, it was like, this is not real. Yeah, the standards have to go up every
year. But then the next day, didn't they announce that you could have shareable themes? Like that was a legitimate thing the next day, like April 2nd?
I mean, today's April 2nd, right?
Yeah. So
like, yeah, you can share a theme, but the way they did Shelfie was just kind of like, it just looked too goofy. It was some guy on a snowboard upside down. I snowboard, so this is a thing for me. And it just looked like somebody who was an asshole. So I was just like...
But now, did you guys see SelfieBot? Because I like that one a lot better than Google Selfie.
No, what was the SelfieBot?
SelfieBot was literally like this robot that hung around and would take selfie pictures for you so you wouldn't have to. Here's a,
that's hilarious.
I'll link that one for you in the chat right now. It was so good, just because I think it was even less the bot itself, but more just the theme of the video that they created. Just really subtle, and just, you know, people just start posing as though they're taking a selfie. It's good stuff. You should watch that one.
Very cool. Google Plus featured the Auto Awesome button, where you could automatically photobomb your photos with David Hasselhoff.
Yeah, I mean, and there was also
David
Google's...
Hasselhoff has 60 by now, and he's still getting air. He's awesome. Yeah.
There was also Google's Doge.
Doge. There are going to be a million videos this week on the Drill Down website because of all the people.
Doge, as in hiring like a Doge engineer. So it was a pretty good recruiting thing.
Sony had food gadget power sources. An enzyme that transfers food energy to gadgets and involves a voltaic enzyme. Cereals and protein bars filled with protein fiber and charged lithium.
Mm-hmm. There's also Silicon Island, a crowdfunding island to basically relocate a utopia for tech startups and to stop us being held back by overregulation and move everyone to an island.
Guys, that's called Boulder, and it's run by Techstars. You think I'm kidding?
It had an Uber boat that would take people over.
Oh, there you go.
One of my favorite pranks this year was the Netflix. Netflix had two streaming movies available, Netflix productions, and one was Sizzling Bacon and another one was Rotisserie Chicken. And it was basically 45 minutes each of watching a pan of sizzling bacon or a rotisserie chicken on a spit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the weird thing about that is that there was a lot of – back in the day – during Christmas, there was this thing called the Yule Log. I think it still exists.
Right.
And that's what the Yule Log was. It was a camera focused on a fire. Like, just shit that you have in your normal house. A fire, bacon, rotisserie chicken, and just, like, looped.
And they still do that on TV. On
like, WPIX in New York, they still do the Yule Log. And we still have it on all the TVs as they play holiday music. A rotisserie chicken and holiday music, I'm not going to lie. Especially in Boston, that would work really well.
And let's see, one of the other ones is so every year, notably for their April Fools on the Web presentation, the ThinkGeek.com, which is a purveyor of geek products, has
products that support geek culture.
Yes. So they have a selection of products that are featured on their front page, and there's nothing except for the knowledge of the day that it's April 1st. There's nothing on there that says that these aren't real products, and they're sort of wacky, outrageous products. This year they had the Mr. Beard K-Cup driven beard machine, a Nerf nuke, which you launch it and it shoots dozens of miniature Nerf projectiles out. Rosetta Stone Learn Klingon, a flux capacitor car charger, amongst other projects. But the interesting thing about ThinkGeek is in the last few years they've done a survey where they will ask the ThinkGeek customers to vote on which one of these April Fool's products they'd actually like to see in the real world. And the winners of this poll, they actually roll these products out into real products.
And that's tight, because I really feel like the flux capacitor car charger, I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. I had a Mr.
Vegetable or whatever it was called.
Mr. Fusion.
Oh, that's what it was.
I have a feeling, I suspect that the Rosetta Stone Learn Klingon will be a definite, that's a no-brainer.
Mm. I think Rosetta Stone Klingon is definitely a no-brainer. I like the idea. I would definitely spend, I mean, I gave up Facebook for Lent, so I got a lot of free time, so.
Any other notable April Fool's jokes this year that you guys want to talk about or mention?
No.
Yeah, I think
I'm good. I just really miss Gmail Blue. I think they could have. I mean, it sounds stupid, but when you watch that video, it's a brilliant video. If you watch it, it's like, Tosin, you sat there in front of a new product launch for a digital software company.
It was amazing. I will admit that. Intel tried to do the same thing this year with the Intel chip, but I don't think it came off as well as Blue.
Gmail Blue was ridiculous because they basically used all the jargon of a software engineer, a software architect, or a software like product guy trying to tell you what this shit is all about. And then you see it and you're like, oh my God, you tricked me. And it's just so well done.
Well, if you saw Google's video for their Emojify the web for Chrome and for Chrome for Android and iOS, they had a lot of that sort of esoteric tech speak in there too.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of along the same lines. Anyway, so. That's it for this episode of The Drill Down, with the exception of going around the table here and asking you guys, I'll start with you, Dwayne, where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. You can always find me on Google Plus. It's gplus.to/DwayneD. And every week you can find me here in the Drill Down. And you'll probably see next week a thing or two from me on thedrilldown.com in the guest bloggy space.
Nice. Tosin, how about yourself? Where can you find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can find the other ramblings and our sort of new branding that's coming into place for ircwebcast.blogspot.com. We'll really start doing a lot more with that. And finally, you can find all things R2 at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. I have a electronic schematic that I'm putting together soon. Nice. For it.
That's good, because that painting post is getting old on me. I keep on reading it.
As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com. All my social media links are there. If you Google Mr. Babyman on Google. Yeah, I guess that's where you would Google things, right? On Google. All of that stuff is there. That's my social media handle. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. You can let our podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.